This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, one Pennsylvania town feels the pinch after a crackdown on illegal immigration. And should the government push abstinence to adults? Joining us today from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., we've got economist and author Julianne Malveaux. She's the president and CEO of Last Word Productions. From our New York bureau, Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, along with Pedro Noguera, professor in the Steinhardt School of Education at New York University. Welcome to you all, and let's start with the issue of illegal immigration. This town, Hazleton in Pennsylvania, population about 30,000, has a new ordinance. It's been blocked by the courts for the moment, but it fines landlords who rent to undocumented immigrants, allows residents to submit written complaints about a person's immigration status, asks people to register at City Hall if, they're tenants. Is this simply being smart and following what you can do about immigration to the letter of the law, or is this abusive use of the law? Pedro.
I think it's an example of the kind of punitive approach to immigration that's really going to backfire on several cities and states. When you consider how central now immigrant labor is to the U.S. economy, particularly to construction, agriculture, service sector, when you make it difficult for people who are either undocumented or not to live and make a living, you not only affect those industries, but you also affect grocery stores, banks, other businesses that are dependent upon the paychecks of those workers. So I think, as you're seeing now in this town and others that have adopted these kinds of approaches, it's going to backfire and end up hurting businesses there, which I think is not wise and represents, I think, a very foolhardy approach to addressing this issue.
Julianne, there was a similar, it was related case in Georgia where there was a big raid on the town and the town pretty much turned into a ghost town. This is different because in Pennsylvania there was a specific city ordinance passed. But what about the interrelation, as Pedro mentioned, between the economies of these cities and the whole factor of undocumented immigrants who may be working?
Well, undocumented people have been woven into the very fiber of our economy now. There are many industries that do depend on them. There's another case, Farai, in Avon Park, Florida, where the citrus growers are very angry because the mayor there has failed to, he says he will not give permits to establishments that hire undocumented people. So they won't give them operating permits. But you literally see the citrus growers saying, wait a minute, we've got to get, our fruit picked and all of that. So if you look at, first of all, the fact that folks are providing essential labor, but secondly, that folks are spending money. And as you see both in the Hazleton, Pennsylvania case, but also in the Stillmore, Georgia case, when you start talking about cracking down on undocumented people, you're also talking about flows of funds that therefore are denied legitimate business owners, shop holders, and other people like that. I think this is harassment as far as I'm concerned. And I think that, the Immigrant Justice Project at the Southern Policy Law Center might want to take a look at this. There's some folks who might want to take a look at it because it seems to me to be harassment where local officials are taking an aggressive position in the absence of federal action.
Walter, the U.S. district judge who blocked this law from going into effect says it could cause irreparable harm and it was in the public interest to protect residents' access to homes, education, jobs, and businesses. But this also comes at a time when two illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants, depending on what language you want to use, shot and killed someone in the town. And so there's now a lot of animosity. There's a lot of agita. Do you think towns should be allowed to basically set their own rules?
Well, first of all, they have no legal jurisdiction. All these local municipalities are overstepping their authority, and that's why the judge ruled that he did. It's really a conflict embedded in federalism. The federal government has responsibility to regulate immigration. So I think you're going to see a lot of these local ordinances knocked down once they reach federal court. But in the matter of, the town where you had the shooting, look, American citizens are killing people. So if the concern is crime, it should be crime across the board. So I think a lot of this is driven by the politics of fear. And what's really happening is that we haven't really, approached this from the real problem, which is low-wage work and the exploitation of labor in this country. And until we really have an honest discussion about what's going on in this country and why we're seeing such a large influx of individuals from other countries coming into the U.S., legal and illegal, we're always going to operate out of this context of fear.
want to move on to another topic. I'm sure that we're going to get a lot of letters about this. So if you're single and under 30, the federal government wants you to abstain from sex. Basically, the Department of Health and Human Services has this $50 million abstinence education program. And HHS officials say they're not making this a requirement, but they want to offer states an option to combat out-of-wedlock births. So it can allow the states to use federal grant money to tell 20-somethings, that's right, the YouTube, MySpace, Match.com generation to go ahead and just stop doing it. So, but there's this one critic, James Wagner of the organization Advocates for Youth, that told NBC that this is a waste of time and money.
Preaching abstinence to 29-year-olds, 95% of whom have already had sex, isn't going to get the job done. It's really more about ideology than it is about anything else.
Julianne, should we be spending federal money to tell 20-somethings to keep their legs crossed?
This is such a waste of federal dollars. It's ridiculous. This is coming. I mean, if we were going to have people abstain, perhaps Mr. Bush could abstain from making statements. There are whole lots of abstentions that one might agree to or think were okay. But abstain, having 20-somethings adults, these are grown people, abstain from sex does not make any sense to me. Especially, it doesn't make sense to have $50 million federal dollars out there. What else could be done with those dollars, Farai? What kinds of actual interventions under Health and Human Services, you know, AIDS prevention, other things, could we use those dollars for? So I think it's the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard.
Pedro, but, you know, single mother out-of-wedlock births happen among 20-somethings. And, you know, I dare say among 30-somethings and 40-somethings, too. But is this a good use of government money just to say, look, you know, if you're not married, if you're not ready? That's the main justification in this case, out-of-wedlock births.
Not at all. I mean, when you consider the major threat, for example, of STDs like genital warts, which a very high percentage of the population has right now, and it's linked to cervical cancer. The idea that we would spend $50 million to push abstinence instead of educating the public on the dangers of STDs and HIV is just, it's not just ludicrous, it's just such a misdirection of priorities and funds, and allowing the ideology of the religious right to really determine policy. And I think it's really a shame that that's where we are at this point in time.
Walter, I have another option to put on the table for you. I went to Japan a few years ago, and they have a different situation, but there's a very low birth rate there. So the government was considering starting a matchmaking service. So maybe you could spend some of that $50 million on a matchmaking service so that you wouldn't have all the out-of-wedlock births. What do you think?
Well, it's a news day that slow.
We got more news to talk about, but you know what? This is a serious government issue.
Well, it's serious because if we take it out of the silliness of political rhetoric and really put it in the public health context. And the irony here is that this is just another one of those glaring contradictions of conservative Republican leadership, because it really betrays conservative principles of limited government and intruding into private lives. I mean, part of the irony of this administration is they completely contradict their own ideology when it comes to the reach of government. This is such an overreach for our government, and I think people should be offended by it, because when you look at the critical public health issues that we're facing in the United States, whether it's AIDS or smoking, and by the way, you know, this is the same administration that wouldn't dare attempt to reach into the firearm industry to talk about gun control, but then reaches into the personal lives of individuals to try to talk about abstinence, and by using the strength and power of the federal government to do so. So I think we have to be clear that this isn't even a public health issue the way they framed it. This is all about politics and rhetoric to try to mobilize their base once again.
Walter, speaking of mobilizing the base, you have Reverend Al Sharpton now criticizing the Christian right for focusing too much on issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. And he wants black churches to reevaluate and really talk about issues like poverty, equal access to education. So is he on the right track? Has he got an uphill battle?
Well, you know, it's real interesting. Right now, there is an internal battle going on among the religious right, because some of the religious right have begun to take on issues of environmental justice. And there is a real fissure within the ranks of the Christian right, because I think some ministers on the right are beginning to say what Reverend Sharpton is saying is, look, we can't narrow our concern to these political issues. There are larger issues out there. And if we're really going to talk about keeping aligned with our faith, then we can't turn our backs on these other issues, like what's happening to the environment, what's happening to the poor. So I think Reverend Sharpton's comments are actually very timely and visionary, because I think that there's an opportunity to build a bridge between the faith folks on the right and the left, because I think there's enough room out there that allows them to operate within their own religious beliefs, but on a platform that suggests, you know, values around human rights.
Julianne?
I'm excited at what the Reverend Sharpton is saying. I think it's long overdue. The 2004 election, by and large, was won because the right was able to make incursions into the African-American community around personal issues. You know, if you don't like abortion, don't have one. If you don't like gay marriage, don't marry any gay people. I mean, these should not be the issues which, you know, people are voting when you have a poverty rate among African Americans as 25% when the minimum wage has not been raised in 10 years. So I think that it's entirely appropriate. This criticism is entirely appropriate. It seems that he's had a partnership with some of the Christian right to begin to talk about this, but I wish they'd talk about it more. And I wish, you know, people would look at the New Testament and look at what the Bible says about poverty, or the Bible says about the least of these. I mean, you don't hear very, very many sermons about that. And by the way, if people want to deal with people's personal behavior, I mean, people talk about gay marriage, but why not talk about adulterers? I mean, if you started preaching against adultery, every church in America would be empty.
Pedro, what do you think of
some
the
pulpits too?
Yeah,
<I'm sorry>.
True. What do you think about Walter's idea that there can be a bridge between left Christians, right Christians, or people of faith on different sides of the political aisle?
Well, I like the idea in principle, because you would think that people who are interested in kind of core Christian values would have concern about issues like poverty, the condition of children in the United States, education, health, etc. But you get the sense when you look at the way some of these, particularly Christian right leaders, have conducted themselves in the political arena, that they're not much more than hacks for the Republican administration. You know, the fact that they would make gay marriage and that they would try to tarnish the reputations of good, decent people by reducing their positions to a single issue like abortion, I think speaks to the way in which religion gets manipulated in politics, and it results in, I think, a larger segment of the public just losing faith in the religious leaders themselves, because they see them as really nothing more than political hacks.
Julianne, we got one last topic. There was an incident in Ohio, Hudson, Ohio. Basically, fans, if you can call them that, wore Afro wigs and blackface at a playoff game for Pee Wee football leagues. The children on the teams were between 7 and 11 years old. The fans say they wore the wigs and the blackface because the team nickname is the Blackhawks. Mm-hmm. Now, compare this to a hood party at Johns Hopkins University in my hometown of Baltimore. A fraternity asked that the partygoers dress in gold chains, wear grills, sagging jeans, and the university is really cracking down on this fraternity. But I just wanted to sort of ask you guys to think in a comparative manner about these two incidents. We often talk about instances of racial prejudice, unfortunately, because they keep happening. Is there some kind of a way to evaluate, you know, blackface targeted at kids versus a hood party targeted at teens and adults? You know, how do you make sense of what is an appropriate reaction to racial incidents like this?
Well, you know, they're both incidents are inappropriate, Farai. I mean, the theme I got when I looked at this was, oh, wow, they have races from 8 to 80. Not that that's new information, but for someone to do this with little children, I think is even more egregious. The, you know, fraternities are inherently stupid, and so campus humor is inherently ignorant. But we've had the spate of you know, use of black culture and bling culture and, you know, et cetera, on campuses. This isn't the first time it's happened. There has to be zero tolerance for it. I know all the free speech people are going to say lighten up, but there really has to be zero tolerance for this kind of racial hazing. But I would say it's worse when you're looking at children from 7 to 11 than when you're looking at college students.
I mean, you know, Walter, again, it's a, I do think that there may be a difference between the kids and the teens slash adults. Do you perceive that or not so much?
Well, there's no statute of limitations on ignorance, and it's ignorance at both ends. And for children, it's usually ignorance through the eyes of an adult. So I think we've got a lot of work to do in terms of making sure that children aren't exposed to adults, because this is learned behavior. For college students, and I went to college, you know, down the road from Hopkins at Morgan State, and I will tell you, you know, there's always been an issue at schools like Hopkins and other places, because if you look at the student population at Hopkins, the numbers are still minuscule in terms of Black students attending those institutions. And I think institutions like Hopkins and other places across the country have a lot of work to do, because every now and then you see some of these incidents, you know, bubble up to the surface, but it's not like they don't happen on a regular basis. So I think we still have a lot of work to do in terms of addressing ignorance on issues of race.
And that definitely, I mean, in one of the articles about this, there were some sophomores who said that they believed that the fraternity theme illustrated many negative feelings towards Baltimore, which is a predominantly Black city. And, you know, certainly there are a lot of Black Baltimoreans who I've spoken with who said, yeah, Hopkins isn't that welcoming a place. And the question is whether the university will step up to the plate. Pedro, since you're on a university campus, what should universities be expected to do in situations like this? Very briefly.
Well, the bigger issue, I think, in Baltimore is the fact that Hopkins does so little for Baltimore. Here you have a major medical center in a very poor community with great health needs. And its commitment to Baltimore has been terrible. It's they pretty much have built walls around that university, despite the fact that it's located in a very needy community. I mean, those are the larger issues. When you see an incident like this, where there's this blatant kind of racial insensitivity and bias, it really just digs at people who have for many years known that that university is not a real member of its community, not been a source of help, and on top of that, as a place where there are these kind of racist views. And it makes it very difficult for a university like that to claim that they're offering services and a value to the city that they're in.
All right. Well, we'll have to discuss more about these issues later. Pedro Noguera, professor in the Steinhardt School of Education at NYU, Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, and economist Julianne Malveaux of Last Word Productions. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Farai.